It's Wednesday, September the 2nd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today, the intrepid trio of Jennifer Bray, Pat Leahy and Harry McGee from our politics team. And it is back to school time, but it's also back to the Dáil time. The Dáil reconvenes early today. It's been recalled because of various events which have taken place over the last couple of weeks. Harry, you have a look at what's upcoming in today's newspaper.
Yeah, Hugh, it wasn't meant to return until the 18th of September, which is another fortnight away. But unfortunately for the body politic, a small event happened during August that kind of put everything into disarray, now called Golfgate, inevitably. There's a gate will append every controversy in politics from here to evermore. But the fallout from it essentially spooked the government into recalling the Dáil early to deal with the consequences of that. And I'm not trying to dismiss the consequences because they were very serious indeed. We had a second Minister for Agriculture falling on his pitchfork in quick succession and relatively quickly followed up by the biggest scalp. And I'm not trying to make it into a game or to diminish the importance, but it took a week before Phil Hogan actually resigned after the controversy first erupted. But from the weekend, at least, the writing was on the wall. Anyone of us who has seen controversies like this pan out before knew that Phil Hogan's goose was cooked, to put it mildly. And the controversy continues. The Oireachtas Golf Society is probably no more. There is a Supreme Court judge, a newly appointed Supreme Court judge, facing an inquiry at the moment in relation to his attendance of that. And it's a little bit reminiscent, though, of a very different scale of the controversy surrounding the appointment of Harry Whelehan as president of the High Court back in the 1990s. So that's the reason and the pretext for recalling the Dáil this week. There's very little on the agenda today. It's a half day. Other than that, there is the new Criminal Justice Amendment Act, which gives Gordy fairly wide-sweeping powers of enforcement. Jack Horgan-Jones and Jennifer were reporting on that this morning. And that's going to be debated in the Dáil this afternoon. I think it'll be one of the pieces of COVID legislation that won't go through easily. I think there are concerns that have been raised by civil liberties groups and by the opposition in relation to this piece of legislation. For its part, the Gardaí argued that they detected 165 breaches of COVID guidelines in pubs serving food during the course of the past few months, but were unable to do anything to deal with it. So that's the second big piece of business. And then there's a third piece, which is necessitated by Golfgate, so-called. It's the appointment of the new Minister for Agriculture. And I'd be very surprised indeed if it's not Charlie McConnellogue, who was Fianna Fáil spokesman on agriculture, but didn't make the senior ministerial grade in the first round. I think a junior minister will also be announced today to replace him or whoever Micheál Martin chooses to be Minister for Agriculture. And also there's a COVID committee meeting today as well, which is looking at the issue of education. The Minister for Education, Norma Foley, I think will appear before it to discuss the various issues in relation to the Leaving Cert, to the return to primary school, etc., etc.
So, I mean, Jen, there's quite a lot on the agenda there. I mean, the legislation is quite significant. I think the opposition's main concern expressed about it has been that it's been lashed together a bit too quickly, so perhaps hasn't been run through the various kind of sanity checks that these things need. And there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing as it was being put together, particularly around the question of parties in private residences, so-called house parties, and, you know, what powers, if any, the guards should have to step in on those, and the government rode back and all that. But it's a pretty significant thing.
It is pretty significant, and I think you're right to single out the issue of the house parties, because what had happened was that a memo was prepared for Cabinet which would have effectively made it an offence to have any more than six people in your house. And what we reported it on Friday morning, and I think then what happened was there was a lot of public reaction to it. There was a lot of stakeholder reaction to it, talking about how it was probably unconstitutional, and, you know, there's a whole range of constitutional issues in relation to going into somebody's home. So that played out on Friday morning, and I think before the Cabinet meeting or just as it started, it was taken, it was reworded basically, and there was what I'm told is a robust conversation about it having even gone to Cabinet in the first place, given that it probably is unconstitutional. And then we heard over the weekend that the new plan was to crack down on college parties. So it seemed to be changing actually quite a lot. But in terms of the legislation itself, so this is legislation that will give Gardaí the powers to go in and close a pub in the first instance for a day, where there are second and third breaches for 7 days and for 30 days. And there's a lot of other details in the legislation. For example, a premises, a license holder will have to affix a notice to the outside of, in a conspicuous place, to the outside of the premises stating the closure order, how long it's for, and the details so that everybody could see it. Obviously, that would be a deterrent, and those who don't put up such a notice will be fined. There's obviously other sections of the legislation which stated that if you attempted to prevent a guard from coming in to, I suppose, inspect the premises, that there would also be a fine and potential jail sentence for that. So there's a number of different elements to the legislation. It is quite, some people have said it's quite draconian. It's definitely wide-reaching, and there were concerns last Friday, especially amongst opposition politicians, that this was going to be rushed through the Dáil, that mistakes were going to be made, and that it was going to end up being an embarrassment, that politicians would be left red-faced, particularly the opposition politicians. So what they did was they had a meeting of the business committee and they discussed how to get ahead of this. So they asked the department for a copy of the draft legislation that was sent out on Friday night. Now, there were big gaps in it, but they got the gist of it, and the vast majority of it was there. So they had an opportunity to examine it effectively and to see if there was anything maybe that the government hadn't spotted or things that could cause problems down the line. So to a certain degree, a lot of the, I was speaking to people over the weekend, opposition leaders, who said that they were by and large quite happy with it. Maybe there were one or two things, but they felt that their worries were addressed, I suppose, by having sight of it. So what happens now is that it goes before the Dáil today. The government were hoping that it would actually get through quite quickly. But I do think that there will be strong exchanges on it. And like, let's not forget that the last sitting of the Dáil was extremely acrimonious. It was vitriolic, in fact, and it had to be suspended a number of times. And I think a lot of frustration and a lot of anger has been building up over the summer, the short summer, should I say. We had multiple calls for the Dáil to be recalled. In the first instance, because of schools, people were very worried about what was happening in the UK and what was happening in Scotland in terms of their exam results. And then, of course, Golfgate, like Harry mentioned, came to the fore. And I think we'll see a flavour of all of that today. But there's a lot bubbling away, I'll just put it that way.
And just a quick follow-up on that. When you say there was a robust exchange of views at cabinet level, that the legislation perhaps wasn't ready to be brought to that level, I mean, that I pricked up my ears at hearing that, because there was a similar brouhaha obviously a couple of weeks ago between Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin about new regulations in relation to COVID being brought to cabinet and not going through the full kind of subcommittee process first. Is this a similar thing?
Sort of. I mean, this is different in that the argument was over the substance of a proposal that was brought to cabinet. Now, it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to people on the Fianna Fáil side, they'll tell you that the previous week they'd actually been given sanction to go ahead and introduce these penalties for house parties. And by the way, I'm sure there'll be plenty of people who will give out when they hear me saying house parties, because it's not always a party. It could be a brunch, a gathering, a birthday. And that's what I mean. I'm just using that phrase. So if you talk to the Fianna Fáilers, they'll say they were given permission by the government at large the previous week to go ahead and do this. If you talk to the Fine Gaelers, they'll say that that's not what was intended, and that they were, to put it as one person said to me, just a bit gobsmacked that something could be brought to cabinet that was so clearly unconstitutional. And they were kind of looking at the memo and reading it and kind of holding it back and going, what's this? So depends on who you talk to. But there is still, like, we always knew that there'd be tensions between the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael side. That's playing out now. It hasn't been anything overly serious, bar that comment from Leo Varadkar about, if this is the way we're doing business, we won't be doing business for very long. That was a worrying comment. But other than that, it's all the usual tensions that you'd expect. But I do think that there's another issue in terms of how the parties are the interplay, and it's the communication between their departments. And to me, it's really bad. It's not good. They're not talking to each other. They're not listening to what the other is saying. So when you ask one department or advisor or whoever what's happening, they'll tell you something different, perhaps to a different department. And that's really not okay in a COVID emergency.
Pat, we talked, I think the last time we talked about this subject, we talked about the government not being all on the same track and the kind of the interplay, as Jen says, between the different departments not being what it needed to be, and perhaps the need for some kind of reset. Is there any sign of that happening, or are these problems still there just as they were the last time we talked about them?
I think those problems are still there and we've seen them in recent days. Let me go back momentarily to just the legislation that you discussed earlier. I'm a skeptic on this. Legislation to give extra powers to the Gardaí is almost always, how do I put it, politically performative. It usually happens around road traffic issues with tweaks to speed limits and enforcement powers and drink driving legislation. But it almost always makes very little difference. Its purpose is not so much to change the law, although it does that, but its purpose is to show politicians are doing something in relation or in response to external circumstances and public concern. It brings to mind the old politician's syllogism. We must do something. This is something. Therefore, we must do this. I haven't heard any serious suggestions that COVID enforcement is being hampered by a lack of powers for the Gardaí. I certainly don't think that the Gardaí are saying that with any volume or commitment. To go to your larger question about the sort of lack of cooperation at the highest level of government between the parties, the lack of common purpose, the lack of a shared agenda, the lack of a sense that this government is acting as a unit. I think we've seen that again in recent days with regard to the replacement of Phil Hogan. I know we'll come to talk about that in a few minutes, but you know, Phil Hogan resigned last Thursday night. It's now Wednesday. They've been talking in government since Friday, presumably, about a replacement, and they still haven't managed to name one. Suggestions that I heard last night and indeed early this morning about Fianna Fáil, Fianna Fáil sources saying, look, this is a Fine Gael appointment. They just need to pick the names and we can go ahead with it. Fine Gael sources saying that, Fianna Fáil are opposed to some of the Fine Gael nominees. Fine Gael want to send one nominee. Fianna Fáil wants to send two. All this sort of stuff swirling about, and it's swirling about because A, the government hasn't got on with its business and made a decision. And two, because they haven't sufficiently explained the process that's going on behind the scenes. So, you know, if there is an overriding challenge, aside altogether from the details of the return to school and the Leaving Cert results, which are due next week, I think the challenge for the government as this stall term restarts is to discover that sort of common purpose and implement it across government and demonstrate it to the public.
And Harry, all this happens against the backdrop of we're speaking on Wednesday. Yesterday, on Tuesday, we had the highest number of positive COVID tests since May, which is really very serious, you know, albeit there are fewer hospital admissions and there have been little or no fatalities over the last 2 weeks or so. So it's against the backdrop of, whether you call it a spike or a surge, it's certainly a resurgence of COVID. Now, that might have been expected to some extent, and Ireland is not alone in that. But Ireland now, as Paul Cullen pointed out in the Irish Times yesterday, whereas it was performing well in relation to most other European countries a couple of months ago, it's now slipped right down the league table, or up the league table, depending which way you want to put it.
Yeah, we're actually even below the Swedes at the moment. A few weeks ago, we got worse than the Brits, and that was bad enough. Now we're worse than the Swedes, who have been the whipping boys or the whipping people of Europe in relation to COVID-19 because of the controversial approach they adopted where there wasn't a full lockdown. I think it's temporary. But I mean, one day's figures does not really make a pattern. So while the figures were high yesterday, they could come right down. We've seen the figures vary from day to day, even though when they start looking at the longer term patterns, it's obvious that the figures have been rising and rising alarmingly at some instances when you look at it from the prism of a fortnightly perspective. And in terms of politics, that makes it different. I think that the government thought that once the government had been formed in June, that COVID was relatively under control for the moment, and they would have some time and space to start looking at the very ambitious list of legislation that they have laid out for themselves in the autumn and in the winter, as well as all the other hundreds of items on the programme for government to get it moving. And of course, COVID would be the immediate priority. There was still PUP. There's also the wage supplement to those who are working for companies that have been struggling since COVID started. And there's also the difficulty of trying to retrain people, get people back to work, get sectors which have been moribund back into operation. There was all that. But the fact that the numbers have swelled in recent weeks, Hugh, would suggest to me at least that other things have had to be put onto the back burner, as it were, as they tackle the immediate crisis. And it hasn't been helped, as Pat was pointing out there, by the lack of coherence and, to be quite frank, the bungling by government of so many issues since coming together in June. They're two-thirds through their first 100 days. And I don't think I'd be exaggerated by saying it's probably the worst first 100 days we have seen from an Irish government for quite a long time.
It's definitely the worst first 66 days.
Absolutely, Pat. So I don't have too much hope for the remaining 34 days. They really have just taken their foot out of their mouth long enough just to put the other foot into it. It's just been one mishap after another. And I think one of the difficulties, of course, besides everything else, is the composition of the government. It's a very unusual composition. In the past, we've had one large party, one small or a number of smaller parties, and perhaps independents. But we knew which party was cracking the whip. It's kind of hard to know which party really is cracking the whip in this government. Fianna Fáil are nominally the largest party, but they seem to be the party at this moment which is suffering the most. And Fine Gael seems to have no difficulty in asserting its authority or its identity, whereas the other two parties seem to be struggling very badly in doing that. And I think Micheál Martin has really struggled to find a voice as Taoiseach. He's gone through all the things. He's doing the videos, reassuring people about COVID. He's making the speeches with bits of the requisite Heaney or Yates kind of peppered in. But it's just not working for him at the moment. He just seems to be trying to manage a situation, and there doesn't seem to be an impression so far that he is the person that is going to lead the country out of this particular impasse.
I mean, to what extent, Jen, is this purely a communications problem? And you've been very critical of the communication strategies of the kind of the key government departments, I think rightly so. But we can kind of fall into the trap of just turning this into a kind of media analysis of public performance. But it seems to me that it reflects a broader, deeper, and probably much more serious malaise. Again, Paul, in his piece yesterday, points at the slow reaction of the state to the outbreaks in meatpacking plants in July, or meat processing plants, and the fact that that then allowed COVID to spread into the community, and that they should have acted faster. Questions remain about the speed and efficacy of our testing, and particularly our tracing systems. And to me, all of that is very opaque, and that. What I'm afraid of, I suppose, is that that's more than just a messaging problem. That's a fact that things are not being done as well as they could or should be.
Yeah, I think everything you say there is completely accurate. I think you hit the nail on the head when you use the word malaise, because I think people are exhausted, actually, to be quite honest with you, and it shows. It shows publicly, and for us as journalists dealing with people privately, it definitely shows privately. I do think that's feeding into a lot of the problems that we have at the moment. There just isn't a sense of energy right now behind, you know, various different messaging, behind various different, I suppose, strategies or policies. And that's probably because a lot of people have been working all year, all through the pandemic, all through the summer. I know politicians who went to go take a couple of days away and had to come back on the same day. And just on a human level, like, you'd have to appreciate that people are exhausted. At the same time, you know, they're paid to do this job. We're, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. People need direction now more than ever before. So you could say that you could veer into the territory of perhaps media analysing it, but that kind of maybe misses the point a bit, because if they can't get the message out to the media about what's happening, if they can't answer simple questions, we can only work with what we've got. And that in turn only feeds into a confused message that goes out to the public. And, you know, it's frustrating for us to deal with when you're trying to get an answer to something which is actually quite simple and you're being sent from department to department. And I've never experienced that before on this scale. I haven't. And it just really doesn't help. And I think as well, what you said there about the issues at play, they are far bigger. So you mentioned Paul's piece. He talked about how we don't have a handle on our testing system, that perhaps it was underutilized over the summer, that instead of scaling it up, we scaled it down. And now we're paying the price for that. Now the cases are rising. I think he talked a bit about community transmission. So in a letter that was sent from the acting chief medical officer to Stephen Donnelly on Monday, just gone, when he was lifting the Kildare restrictions, he talked about how community transmission nationally in Ireland is at 36%. I think that'd be a far bigger worry than the spike in the cases that we saw yesterday. It's the level of unknown transmission where you just don't know where it came from. And that is something that I think will become a bigger issue. And if there's anything going to put us back into a national lockdown, if indeed that ever does happen again, you can imagine that that will be it. So there's a whole range of different issues which we haven't really had any clarity on. Like, we don't know where our rapid testing plan is at, or even if we have a rapid testing plan, we don't know what our long-term plan is to deal with COVID, which we were promised multiple times. It's this framework for living alongside COVID. We don't have that yet either. We know that there's serial testing being rolled out across meat processing plants and direct provision centres, but there isn't really any clarity on how, we know it's once a week, but what are the figures from that? What other measures are being taken? What measures are being taken in terms of the, I suppose, the lifestyle and the working conditions that people are existing under? Because until you address that, really, you can test away. But if you have people still presenting for work and working, even if they're sick, because they're not going to get their sick pay, that issue is not going to go away. So there's kind of acknowledgement. I think Stephen Donnelly did an interview in the 6-1 and he said one of the big lessons that we learned from this crisis was about those conditions. But there's no real plan to say, OK, here's how we're going to address that. And that sticks out like a sore thumb. So we've got issues with the testing and tracing. We've got issues with rapid testing, the long-term plan, like the vulnerable areas we talk about there. And there's a whole load of other things. You could kind of talk about it all day, really. And I think as we come into the winter and we know there'll be a flu season, hopefully the flu season will be less because people are indoors more and not socialising more, but it'll still be there. And we know that in the briefing document given to Stephen Donnelly, it warned that there could be a shortfall of 4,700 beds out of a baseline of 11,000 beds. And so we have a huge capacity issue coming at us down the tracks this winter. So we need a winter plan. So that's another thing that's needed. So the task facing this government to keep the show on the road and to keep Irish citizens as safe as possible is absolutely gigantic. And so they need to sort out the basics before we get into that. And the basics is communication, to my mind, before you even get into. Because if you can't communicate what you're doing, it's a bad place to be.
Pat, how right am I to be concerned about just feeling that the hand has been taken off the tiller in some way over the last couple of months? And this is probably a criticism of the media as well as of the political process and the Oireachtas. I don't have a clear picture of what the plan is with testing and tracing to make it better than it was in the past, and where it needs to be, and when it's going to be at that place when it needs to be. Fintan O'Toole was writing this week, making a comparison between Copenhagen Airport and Dublin Airport, the difference that a traveller experiences when they arrive in each of those airports. In Copenhagen, you're offered a free COVID test in the car park as you're leaving the airport, and you get the result, I think, within a matter of hours. In Dublin, up until very recently, you were invited to fill out a form at a table with shared biros on strings and people standing together and huddling around, then handing these over to officials in the airport who didn't seem particularly interested in them. And we know from the Phil Hogan thing, among other things, that there's not much follow-up on those kinds of journeys as well. I'm worried about all this.
Well, let's do our best to reassure you if we can, Hugh. To go back to Jennifer's point, there is certainly a problem with communication in government, and frequently it's been a shambles, and we've seen that at the coalface, obviously, in our work, but I think the wider public gets that as well. However, when governments are criticised for poor communications, often from within, it usually in my experience, masks not just a communications problem, but a problem with the delivery of substantial services, initiatives, and so forth. In other words, when governments say, "Oh, we're doing a fine job, but we just have a difficulty explaining that to the public," it's a communications problem. It nearly always isn't just a communications problem. It's a problem of substance. And I think we're seeing some elements of that here, as you outline with the testing and tracing, though to some extent we will, I think, see a plan for that when the medium-term plan is published, I guess, in the next few weeks. But the government needs to get on with that. We're through the early phase of COVID now. We're into the living with the disease phase, and we don't as yet have a plan for managing that. The previous plan on the reopening from the lockdown, that has run out effectively. The country is reopened to a certain extent, and it's the plan for the next phase of reopening and then maybe closing down bits and pieces. As we've seen, we don't as yet have a strategic framework published by the government that demonstrates to us what things look like in 2 months' time, in 3 months' time, 6 months' time, or what their view of that is. So that is, as I say, a problem of substance, not just a problem of communications. And it may very well be when that plan is worked out and when it's ready that we will see those communications problems manifest themselves at that point. But it's a bigger thing to get the actual plan together, to get the testing and tracing infrastructure up and running, which we haven't seen in sufficient with sufficient facility to date. That having been said, I think there are some bright spots for the government. So the schools are back. Parents all over the country were terrified over the summer that this thing wasn't going to get off the ground. The schools are back. Now, the inevitable outbreaks in schools will have to be managed quickly and cleverly by the health authorities, and the government will have to explain to people what's going on with those. But the schools are back. There is a framework for the Leaving Cert results, which was elaborated on yesterday by the Minister for Education, which has gained broad acceptance. Now, the results aren't out yet, but the plan for them and the mechanism that has been put in place to judge Leaving Cert results of students has been broadly welcomed. And I think that if the government gets those things right, and if it can demonstrate that it has, as I said earlier, this common purpose, and that is producing these results that people may say, well, look, at least they got the schools back, at least they could manage that, the Leaving Cert results went okay, then I think there is a chance that the government can progress to the longer term COVID plan, the budget, the plan for economic recovery that will accompany the budget. Then I think there's a chance that they can get those off the ground. But looking at their operations up until now, not just communication, but in the formulation of policies and plans, you'd have to say there's no guarantee of it.
What do you think of that, Harry?
I broadly agree. I think the Social Democrats are out at 2 o'clock today, and I think one of the net things that they're saying, I think they are making a valid point, is that the government's plan is very short term in relation to COVID-19, and that when you're talking about the medium term, that they really haven't set a pathway. Jennifer reported last month, I think, on the change in terms of the way that COVID-19 would be dealt with by government, moving away from a temporal pathway to one in which the government agencies and the departments would be able to deal with different types of situation as they arose. And as Jennifer reported, they had every colour in the rainbow except for the colour green, which is green for go. I actually think that particular plan is quite difficult to get your head around. I don't think people have the same ownership of that plan as they had with the last one. And I think one of the things that the Social Democrats are saying today, and I think it's a fair point, is that a thought out, articulated plan to deal with the medium-term COVID implications is necessary. And I just return to the point that I was making at the start in relation to the programme for government, Hugh. It's huge. And, you know, a lot of the action, especially in relation to climate change, needs to be implemented sooner rather than later. And we will wait to see what Government Chief Whip Jack Chambers unveils in his legislative programme. But the government really needs to begin work on that as well. I mean, I know that COVID-19 is dominating the national discourse, as it should, but there is other business of government that needs to be attended to as well. And as we saw this week, I mean, they're trying to reintroduce some semblance of normality, of a society functioning as normally as possible. And part of that is that the more mundane and pedestrian cogs of government begin to operate again. And there hasn't been any strong evidence of that. It just seems that everything has been put into suspension or abeyance while the government awaits action in relation to COVID-19. And there's a very famous saying from the American Civil War, which said, you know, the army that wins is the army that gets there fastest with the mostest. And that should really be the rallying cry for every political party, not only during an election campaign, but also when in government, that, you know, there is no time to relax, that you have to be able to deal with all the situations that arise, all eventualities across the full spectrum and plethora of issues. And I think that's something that the government hasn't been able to do since. And I'll just return to the point that Pat was making earlier on about the lack of coherence in the government. I mean, it has been incredibly inept in the first 66 days. And, you know, I was talking to Pat about this yesterday, and he was saying, it's, you know, the government can't but survive. It can't but succeed because of the scale of the crisis that we have at the moment. But the evidence that it presents to us on a daily basis points to everything but that. You know, the government has just struggled so badly in its first 2 months of existence that you do worry about its if it survives or not. Two of the parties, there are massive problems internally with them, in them. The Greens have, you know, at least three of its TDs who are semi-detached at the very kindest in relation to this government. There's a Just Transition Ginger Group, which is intent on taking the Greens out of government. Fianna Fáil has a huge number of internal issues that it has to work through as well, and hasn't even begun to start to work through those as yet. And Fine Gael is doing okay at the moment, but I'm sure that Fine Gael is going to face a couple of road bumps in the next couple of weeks and months as well. So as Pat was saying, there is a need for this government to present itself as a government, not a kind of a loose, heterogeneous a collection of three very separate parties who happen to be in the same room, all with one hand on the steering wheel, but not quite sure in which ship the particular, which direction this particular ship is going.
Given all that, Jen, does it make sense to release Simon Coveney from his bondage in this unhappy government and send him off to Brussels, and then not only create a vacancy in a vital position in the run-up to the ending of the interim period, the full departure of Britain from the UK at the end of this year, plus he's one of the most experienced ministers, plus he's been in that post for a long time, he represents continuity, presumably there's some form of mini reshuffle would have to take place as a result of that. Is he not better off staying where he is?
Perhaps, and I actually think that this is probably the biggest reason why we haven't had full clarity on what's happening with that post yet. And it's around Simon Coveney and around the decision that he has to make about his future. So you could make that argument that he's sort of more useful back here at home, that he, in his position as Foreign Affairs Minister, has a very strong grasp on the Brexit brief, knows all of the key players, knows exactly what's at stake, especially at this crucial time. We're only weeks away from the end of the year. And I think that is definitely a very strong argument, perhaps, for him staying. The argument for him going could have been that if we could retain that key trade portfolio, that he could potentially have an even bigger clout there. But of course, we don't know. And there is no clarity about whether we do retain that trade portfolio. So if we take, for example, that we don't, and that we get perhaps a portfolio of lesser import, Would he go? Would it be worth his while going? Would he want to go? Would it make sense for him personally? Would it make sense for him politically? And I think that that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks to, and one of the reasons why we don't actually have an answer about who our nominees are, because it seems to me what's happening is that he would put his name forward, let his name be put forward, if he felt that there was, if not the trade portfolio, a portfolio of equal import. And that's just not a given. And on the flip side, Ursula von der Leyen has clearly said she wants a male and a female nominee. So if you run Simon Coveney alongside someone like Mairead McGuinness, who's in the mix, it would appear that Ursula von der Leyen looks very favourably upon Mairead McGuinness. Would that result in Simon Coveney effectively being left red-faced, even though I personally don't think it would be an embarrassment at all, but a lot of people think it would be a political embarrassment. You know, so there's all of these issues at play at the moment, and I don't see personally the European Commission telling the Irish government, here's what portfolio you will have, and them making a decision on that basis. I think Simon Coveney might have to make a leap of faith.
Pat?
I think that's exactly right. And Naomi reports this, Naomi Leary, our Europe correspondent, reports this in this morning's paper, that the allocation of portfolio will depend on the person who is nominated. So if the Irish government nominates two people for the position, they will then be, you could call it a job interview, or will certainly be conversations with Ursula von der Leyen, who will then indicate to the Irish government who her preferred nominee is, and at that point undertake a reshuffle if necessary of the portfolios. I'm hearing very strongly from Brussels that it's very unlikely that trade would be retained by the new Irish commissioner, and I think that is more or less accepted in Dublin at this stage. As Jen says, the danger for Simon Coveney, if he allows his name to go forward, is that he either doesn't get the job because Ursula von der Leyen wants to pick the woman who is nominated alongside him, or who's suggested alongside him, or he does get the job, and it would be quite a rebuff, I think, from the European Commission to turn down the nomination, or the offered nomination of, you know, former Deputy Prime Minister, current Minister for Foreign Affairs, Deputy Leader of his party. That would be quite a rebuff to turn him down in favour of a serving MEP. But even if he was accepted, that he would get at best a mid-ranking portfolio, and at worst, a portfolio that has little impact either in Brussels or in Ireland. So I don't think that Simon Coveney will get absolute clarity from Brussels on what portfolio he might get, or even if he would get the job. So ultimately, he will have to either take that gamble or decline to take it.
And just to pursue one further point on that, Pat, it is the case, isn't it, that should the government survive to that point, Fianna Fáil have the right to nominate the next commissioner, which is about two years or tad over 3 years away, might be before the next election. So in terms of his sort of long-term plan, Simon Coveney, who's somebody who's in this political prime in a very senior position here, is it not a slightly odd choice to make?
Well, this is, you know, I mean, the job of European Commissioner is something that has, you know, always been sought after by politicians in all countries for lots of reasons. You're at the very epicenter of power in the European Union, and of course, it opens up all sorts of career possibilities for people who have served in the Commission and go on to various advisory roles and so forth. But you're right; it would be. It would amount to Simon Coveney, and there's nothing to say that he could not come back to Irish politics, though that tends to be not what happens. And it would look like, at least on the face of it, giving up his political career in his, there he is, in his late 40s, deputy leader of his party, defeated
for the leadership of his party a couple of years ago, but certainly the general consensus around Fine Gael and around Leinster House would be that Simon Coveney's leadership ambitions have not entirely been extinguished. So yeah, he would be giving up an awful lot. It would be a change for him and presumably his family, who might have to move to Brussels. He would be, for a time anyway, and probably for good, giving up Irish politics. So yeah, it's a really big choice for him to make. I would say one other thing is that it would also, I think, represent a serious deterioration or serious degrading of Fine Gael's political clout. Simon Coveney is somebody who is not just well regarded within his own organisation, as the result of the Fine Gael election, leadership election, showed when he won the vote amongst the party membership. But I think he's somebody who enjoys a high degree of credibility amongst ordinary voters because of his handling of Brexit. So to take that out, and if you cast your mind back to the general election campaign, when about halfway through it, we suddenly saw Simon Coveney dragged into daily press conferences and so forth to give the Fine Gael campaign a boost. So to take that out of the Fine Gael political operation, I think would represent a significant diminishing of Fine Gael's political political punch. But I suppose that's the choice that he must now make. And really, we thought we'd get an answer on this on Monday. We thought we'd get it yesterday. It's really hard to see it going beyond today, I think.
A last quick question to you, Harry. This Dáil is reconvening today in the Convention Centre. Why are they still down there? Can they not order their business in such a way? Do they not have the wit to organise things so that you have a number of people in the chamber at any given time, which is within the permitted regulations, order people coming in and out, some form of remote voting? It doesn't seem that difficult. I mean, from what I gather, you can tell me it's incredibly awkward for the politicians, probably for you guys as well, though that obviously isn't very important at all. I mean, can they not just come back to Leinster House where they should be?
Yeah, it's a very expensive place to have a kip. I'll tell you that. I think the decision to stay in the National Convention Centre is preposterous, Hugh, to be quite frank. You have children being crowded into classrooms around the country and schools effectively managing that by putting them into discrete bubbles. But the absolutely astronomical cost of running the whole show in the National Convention Centre, and on top of everything else, they put in a very expensive sound system at a cost that I think approached or even exceeded six figures in July for something that will be a temporary fix. And the taxi meter continues to turn over in relation to that. And somebody somewhere is going to have to take a decision very soon to return it to the Dáil and to implement the protocols that you outlined there in your questions. You know, I mean, the only time that you ever get the chamber packed to the gills is on budget day. And the only the time really that you get massive numbers in the Dáil is when leaders' questions are on or when there is a vote. And all of those can be managed in the way that the rest of society has ordered its business so as to cope with COVID-19. And the time for the Dáil and the Seanad to return their natural homes has long since passed. I mean, we shouldn't be going into the autumn and into the winter with TDs making that trip across the Liffey to the National Convention Centre to adhere to protocols that, as far as I can see, have not been required in any other facet of Irish life. So I think it's ludicrous. And I think it should stop, and it should stop now.
Okay, we'll start that movement right here, right now. We'll leave it there for today. Thanks very much to Harry there, to Jennifer and to Pat for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and JJ Vernon, who was on the desk. Don't forget, if you have not already done so, to proceed forthwith to irishtimes.com/subscribe, where you can sign up for unlimited access to the Irish Times at the introductory price of €1 for the very first month. And also, you know, if you want to get in touch with us, we are always delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thank you very much indeed for listening.